Arthur Machen once wrote that strange things are lost and forgotten in obscure corners of the newspaper. This podcast will aim to prove that that statement is true.
Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of Forgotten Darkness. I'm Andrew Gable. First things first, allow me to apologize for the lateness of this episode. I'm not really exactly quite sure why it took me so long to get this one together. Like, I know the story really well. There's nothing I find, like, distasteful or anything about it that would make it hard to write about. So, I don't know, but I apologize. This story's become one of my favorites, though, since I first learned of it several years ago. It contains a practical trifecta of favorite themes of the press of the day. High society, a mysterious villainess, feigning hysterical women, and hypnosis. Papers back then loved hypnosis. People tried to use hypnosis to cover all sorts of salacious activity. After I'm done telling the primary story, I'll cover a variety of hypnosis tales from News of the Day, and you'll see exactly what I mean. I've seen accounts of murders where someone is described as hypnotized to death, but were actually drugged. Apparently, no difference was discerned to the average person between hypnosis and simply being stoned on morphine. The use of the state as a catch-all to cover all sorts of things was aided, to a large extent, by the idea that relatively few people were actually even sure what hypnosis was. But, generally in short, if a malefic mesmerist would be guilty of something in a pulp story, or a German expressionist horror film, be sure that someone, somewhere, actually tried to get away with just that. In February of this year, the story of Konstantinos Danny Filippidis, a 49-year-old firefighter from Toronto, made the rounds of weird news sites. The skier had gone missing from Whiteface Mountain in New York on February 7th, and after a massive manhunt turned up no trace, he was presumed dead. However, a week later he was found in Sacramento, California. He was unharmed. At first he had no memory of what transpired in the past week, or how he found himself nearly 3,000 miles away from where he was last seen. He had gotten a haircut in the missing week and was still wearing a ski gear. After a few days, he had hazy memories of riding in a tractor trailer and having slept a lot. Frank Ramagano of the Toronto Professional Firefighters Association said that even in these answers, Filippidis seemed confused and unable to give direct answers. When the story broke, I mentioned how it reminded me in many aspects of the tale of Clara Coffin from 1903. Clara Josephine Coffin was the 17-year-old daughter of Edward W. Coffin, who was an executive with Standard Oil and an insurance broker. The Coffins lived at 55 Burnett Street in East Orange, New Jersey. She was a student at East Orange High School, and she had two siblings, an older sister named Mariam, and a younger brother named Edward Jr. On the evening of November 3rd, 1903, Clara said she was going over to a neighbor's house to study, and her mother thought that would be a good thing for her. Maybe it would help cheer her up, because she'd been in an odd sort of mood all day. But by later that night, she hadn't returned. Mr. Coffin went over to Jesse Houston's, who was the neighbor that she was going to visit, and was shocked to learn that Jesse hadn't seen their daughter either, and Clara had never even gone there. Upon returning home, Mrs. Coffin discovered that Clara had taken with her two bags containing somewhere between $10 and $12. To put it in perspective, since that's 1903 money, that's between $285 and $345 in today's money. The next day, upon realizing that the girl had the address of her aunt, Mrs. M.A. Gillis of Philadelphia. The Philadelphia police were contacted to see if she was there, and they answered in the negative. In the meantime, Mrs. Coffin went to the local station of the Delaware and Lackawanna Railroad and discovered that Clara had inquired about fares and train conditions between Orange and California. She had a grandmother, also named Clara Coffin, in Los Angeles. This inquiry was backed up by her brother, who said that Clara had told him that she could get to California for $50. He said that he told her she would have pretty poor accommodations at that rate, to which she replied that she didn't really care how she traveled. On November 5th, Mr. Coffin released a statement saying that, "My daughter has never had any romantic attachment for any young man that I know of, and that she went away to meet any young man seems preposterous. She was not in the least romantic, and always seemed to be possessed of extremely good sense. She was pretty and was a belle among her companions, and we often gave little dances and parties at home for her. Yet it looks as though she deliberately planned to go away. She took with her two bags, one of them a red leather satchel of mine, and the other an alligator bag belonging to her mother. She also took a wrist bag belonging to her mother, in which there was $10. She spent some time in the afternoon with her girlfriends, Dorothy Duff, Jesse Houston, and Margaret Webster, and in the evening announced that she was going around the corner to visit Miss Houston for half an hour. We thought nothing of it until she did not return by 10 o'clock, and then I went round to the Houstons to get her. She had not been there. We've had no trace of her since then." A maid backed up one of Mr. Coffin's assertions, stating that it was her belief that Clara just got tired and went away. But she also disputed the statements on how much money was taken along, saying that Mrs. Coffin doesn't know how much money Clara took. There is always money laying around the house, and if she saved anything out of her allowance, we wouldn't know about it. Mr. Coffin had also sent a telegram to a relative, a jeweler named H.T. Coffin in Newcastle, Indiana, who engaged in a search there. The previous summer, the Coffins had attended a family reunion in Newcastle, and it was theorized for a time that she might have gone there. On November 6th, though, a short telegram was received by Mr. Coffin from Mr. Joseph Crow, the postmaster of Omaha, Nebraska, and a relative of the Coffins by marriage. "Clara is here safe." He and Mr. Coffin soon agreed that Mr. Coffin would not start for Omaha from East Orange until Crow telegrammed him back, due to Clara's condition. On the night of the 5th, Joseph Crow had received a telegram from Clara Coffin, asking him to pick her up at the train station at 11 o'clock. Sure enough, he found Clara on a bench in the station, although she seemed exhausted and could barely walk. Once back at the Crow's house, she was confined to bed in a state of nervous prostration. More on this later, though. The next day, Clara was well enough to be seen and furnished to the Omaha Bee an account of what had transpired since November 3rd, after she had eaten, which she claimed not to have done since she first went missing.
"Oh, how happy, how glad I am to have escaped from the woman with the terrible piercing eyes. It seems as though I have lived 100 years in the past few days. It is all like a terrible dream to me. I cannot remember much of what transpired since Tuesday morning. It was like an oppressive dark cloud bearing down on me. I distinctly remember only the beginning and the end of that awful, awful experience. I was returning home from school in East Orange Tuesday afternoon when I met the woman. I had often noticed her before. She always looked at me with a strange, uncanny gleam in her eyes. Occasionally, I passed her on the walk. I avoided her eyes when possible for me to do so. They were black as night and were so awfully piercing. It seemed as if the woman was my nemesis and was trying to secure some influence over me. When I met her Tuesday afternoon, she had that same awful expression in her eyes. That look seemed to have a commanding influence over me, and I felt that I was in her power. She told me that I should and would have to go far away with her. I wanted to disobey this command, to defy her, for I hated her, but I feared her so that I did not dare. We walked together to the house. The woman waited for me at the gate while I packed my valise. I did not see any of the family while I was making preparations to depart. Everything seemed so hazy and misty to me then. I felt as if I was unable to disobey that awful, awful woman with the piercing eyes. After we left the house, we entered a closed carriage. Then everything became dark and blank. My next recollection is that of being on a railroad train, and I think we were just leaving New York then. Then everything became blank again until yesterday. When I came to, I determined, if possible, to free myself from that terrible spell. There was a little fat man with us then. I do not know where he got on the train. He was seated in the front of the car. The woman with the awful eyes had left me for a moment and was talking with him. Just then, the train porter came through our car. I hastily wrote a message to my cousin in Omaha and requested him to send it for me. Then my nemesis returned. She gazed at me in her queer manner. With all the force of mind I possessed, I resisted that gaze. I pretended to sleep. As the train was entering the city, the woman again left me and entered into conversation with the fat man in the front of the car. She evidently thought I was beyond power of escape. Then the train stopped at the depot. The aisle of the car was crowded with passengers. Unobserved, I slipped out the door and to the side of the train opposite the depot. I did not care to create a scene in the city to which I am a stranger. I am going to my cousin in Omaha tonight and will stay there until Papa comes to take me home. I will never forget that terrible woman and will be able to identify her anywhere. Oh, how I have suffered in the last few days. I will never, never forget it.
Also on November 2nd, it was reported that her parents think that, mentally unbalanced by study, their daughter conceived the idea of visiting her cousin. Regarding the story from Omaha that the girl had been abducted and managed to escape, Mr. Coffin said that it was probably an invention of her deranged mind. Her cousin, in that quote, refers to Hazel Crow, the daughter of Joseph Crow, who Clara had met at the family reunion in Indiana, discussed earlier. Mr. Crow, meanwhile, stated that Clara's mind is all right. She is weak in body and mind both, from the long time she was under the hypnotic influence, but otherwise she is all right. In other accounts, Clara indicates that the man and the woman both spoke French. But discrepancies begin to show themselves that same day. Her story states that she saw none of the family when she got home that afternoon, that she packed her things and left. But the testimony of both parents indicates the contrary, that they had seen Clara for several hours after she got home, and she didn't leave until shortly after 8 o'clock that evening. Her story is also, as reported in some articles, indicates that when she reemerged from the house, the man was with the woman at the gate. But in the Omaha Bee account quoted above, she says she didn't see the man until they were on the train already. This detail, at least, though, in my mind, can probably be chalked up to transmission between different newspapers and a story getting changed as it's in the hands of different journalists. But as well, C.A. Hamlin, who was conductor of a train on the Northwestern Railroad on which Clara was traveling, stated that she was alone on the train and there was no man or woman with her. It was also determined that the telegram for Mr. Crow was sent from the train station in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, rather than the train itself, as Clara's story would indicate took place. So as to the state of nervous prostration Clara found herself in, I had always thought that nervous prostration was essentially just a descriptive word referring to fainting or passing out. But it apparently was an actual pseudo-medical diagnosis. It was usually called neurasthenia. By definition in dictionaries of the day, quote, the disease is popularly defined as a functional derangement of the nervous system with depression of the vital forces due to prolonged overwork or nervous strain. As psychiatrist E.H. Van Doysen described it, among the causes, excessive mental labor, especially when conjoined with anxiety and deficient nourishment, ranks first. It is also traceable to depressing emotions, grief, domestic trouble, prolonged anxiety and pecuniary embarrassment, hemorrhage and debilitating diseases following or coincident with depressing mental influence and sleeplessness. It is likely that so-called neurasthenia was actually a conflation of cases of both nervous breakdowns and chronic depression. Although occasionally symptoms of other mental disorders were presumably mistaken for neurasthenic symptoms as well. Clara Coffin returned to East Orange on November 14th, and to all appearances, the circumstances of her trip to Omaha were never really brought up by her parents. And here the story would have ended, except for some information I discovered only a few months ago. Almost 8 years to the day after her return, on November 15th, 1911, she was married to Selskar M. Gunn, an epidemiologist and later professor at MIT. A daughter, Barbara, was born in the United States, and Clara moved to Europe with her husband in 1917, who by that time had become employed by the Rockefeller Foundation. Their daughter, on the other hand, they felt was too sickly to travel, and she was left in the care of Mr. and Mrs. Coffin. Gunn was a prolific letter writer, and several of his letters contain references to Clara's continued health problems. In 1921, he wrote to Frederick Russell, and in the letter he mentioned that Mrs. Gunn is bothered with neuralgia again. And another letter that same year, written to Wycliffe Rose, refers to the fact that the mother's ill health was apparently passed on to the daughter as well. As you may know, Mrs. Gunn and I have left in America our young daughter who is staying with her grandparents. It appears at the present time that her grandparents must go to California in June for at least 2 months. It would be impossible for them to take the child with them, and it is very difficult to find some person who could take care of Barbara during their absence. Barbara, who has been a sick child practically all her life, at the present time is distinctly better, and we are hopeful that from now on she is going to be much stronger. Mrs. Gunn feels, and I agree with her, that it will be necessary for her to return to America in June and take care of Barbara. It is by no means certain that it will be wise at this time to have Barbara brought back to Prague with Mrs. Gunn. Of course, it might be possible to leave the child in America and have Mrs. Gunn return to Prague later on. I feel that a new separation of myself and my family must be avoided. Unfortunately, none of the three of us are very husky. Mrs. Gunn's health is nothing famous. She has had a hard siege for years and is by no means strong. Clara and Barbara rejoined Gunn in Europe later, but by November 1925, Clara was once again suffering a good many attacks of internal pain, and Barbara, who was likely aged around 10 at this point, although considerably recovered from a few years previous, was still obviously a delicate and nervous child. This description, incidentally, was identical to that used to describe Clara herself in the first news articles from the time of her disappearance. A short time later, the two were formally divorced, for reasons I have yet to discover. Gunn never mentions her or their daughter after they're divorced, and to the best I could determine, neither do the newspapers. So what truly befell Clara Coffin upon her disappearance? Was her ill health throughout her married life merely an after effect of the nervous prostration she found herself afflicted with upon arrival in Omaha? I was previously inclined to agree with her parents and believe that the stress of overwork in school and the prospect of her nearing graduation, as well as a noted, uninspired, somewhat aimless nature, which, I mean, on second thought, really isn't much different than the majority of teenagers, may have culminated in a nervous break or a fugue state of some sort. But, given the testimony of Selskar M. Gunn, as well as a more thorough understanding now of what exactly nervous prostration actually referred to, I'm now considering the possibility that it all might have been due to some undeniably physical, or possibly even mental, condition. I hesitate to speculate about any one specific mental issue. After all, I'm not a psychologist, and it's ill-advised to try to diagnose someone based solely on what's written about them in newspapers, but I kind of wonder if the dark-eyed woman could have been some sort of hallucination, a projection, if you will, of Clara's subconscious. Perhaps the compulsion emanating from the woman was nothing more than a plan forming in Clara's subconscious mind. Alton, Illinois, Evening Telegraph, November 27th, 1900. San Francisco, November 27th. N.C. Palmer, a businessman, is seeking a divorce on the grounds that his wife, formerly Mrs. Fanny Stockton, married him against his will while he was in a hypnotic fog. He also declares she hypnotized the Reverend C.O. Brown, whose forced resignation from the pastorate of the First Congregational Church caused comment a few years ago. Mr. Brown later went to Chicago, where he had more trouble. Mrs. Palmer is said to be in Chicago at present. In his complaint, Palmer alleges that prior to November 25, 1896, he met the widow Stockton frequently, but neither desired nor thought of marrying. On the date mentioned, she called at a store in Oakland with a woman friend and announced, "You and I are to be married today." By the use of a hypnotic power, she nullified his reasoning faculties and cast his mind into a trance, and thus compelled him to be a party to a marriage ceremony, the significance of which he was actually unconscious of at the time. A week after the marriage, the defendant confessed she had used a hypnotic power to secure him as a husband, and that the motive was a mercenary one, as she was embarrassed financially. The bill avers that the defendant then obliged him to pay certain debts contracted by her before the marriage, and that through the mysterious hypnotic influence exerted over him, he was compelled to live with and support her, although she was of a petulant, waspish, and profligate nature, and caused him great mental anguish. Palmer claims the woman boasted of having hypnotized others, her first victim being her former husband, Frank Stockton, whom she drove mad. She next spellbound an old man who educated and maintained her. Then she hypnotized the Reverend C.O. Brown. Mr. Palmer says she boasted that at one time she controlled the preacher so completely that he offered to secure a divorce from his wife and marry her. Whenever Mrs. Stockton required money, the Reverend gentleman provided it during his previous prosperous days. She claimed to have been the direct cause of his expulsion and gloated over it. She declared that all who came to her aid did so because they were unable to resist the spells which she, as a sorceress, cast over them. Palmer declares that it was not until she became disgusted with his failure to make money that she left him and went to Chicago. Then he recovered his mental faculties and finally succeeded in shaking off her power. Reverend C.O. Brown of San Francisco was suspended after Mrs. Mary A. Davidson learned of an infidelity he had had with a young woman named Martha Overman and blackmailed him for $500 per month for quite some time before he failed to pay, and then Mrs. Davidson brought the charges to light. And upon that, he was so discredited that he was disqualified as a minister. In addition, he had been paying off Miss Overman as well as a Mrs. M.A. Stockton, who seems to be the woman in question, who he had supposedly assaulted. Although this Mrs. Stockton did seem to enthrall him, saying in her own testimony that he was my very shadow and I was silly enough to believe that he would marry me, he admitted himself that he had wronged me. Reverend Brown himself, however, countered that she was a mere blackmailer and had attempted to blackmail any number of wealthy businessmen before him. And at this point, she kind of disappears out of that story. Some more details in a Los Angeles Times article seem to suggest that while the Reverend Brown scandal was behind her, she hadn't changed her M.O. any. Palmer was a businessman, and as was said, she bled Palmer in royal style, and soon her extravagances ruined his business. Then they went east. Palmer tried to shake her, but she would not shake. She stuck to him like a leech until he became stranded and out of work in Buffalo. Once an adventuress, in the Victorian sense of a woman who betters herself by unscrupulous methods, that is, always an adventuress, I guess. San Francisco Examiner, April 23, 1896. John H. James was arrested on Saturday. He had in his possession about $300 worth of jewelry. James tells a very peculiar story of how he came into possession of this jewelry. He says he was hypnotized by a strange man who put the valuables in his hands, telling him to meet the following day when he would give him more. He failed to find the mysterious man at the appointed place in Oakland and came over to this city. When found by detectives Gibson and Wren and policeman Connolly in Chinatown, James was trying to dispose of a gold watch set with diamonds, a pair of diamond earrings, a pearl pin, a plain ring, and a gold watch and chain. He was taken to the city prison, but as he refused to make any statement, he was not booked until yesterday morning, after the property had been identified by Mrs. Mary Thompson of Berkeley. As soon as James learned that Mrs. Thompson had been seen by the detectives, he was anxious to talk, anxious to tell his story. "Were you ever hypnotized?" he said. "No? Well, you may be thankful you have escaped such an unpleasant experience. I was hypnotized last Friday night. That's why I am here. Very unfortunate affair, I assure you, for it is likely to cause my conviction on a charge of grand larceny. It all happened in this way. I was working for Mrs. Mary Thompson, who resides on the corner of Rose and Shattuck Avenues in Berkeley. I did odd bits of work about the place, and as I had no home, no place to sleep, she allowed me to stay in one of the cottages in the rear of her house. The Thompson family retires very early. I have always been accustomed to turning in late, and since I have been there, I got into the habit of reading a while before going to sleep. On Friday night, I was interested in a book, and read on past midnight way into the morning. When I finished the book, it was 4 o'clock. My eyes ached, and as I felt thirsty, I went out into the yard to the hydrant for some cool water. As soon as I stepped into the yard, I saw a light shining through one of the windows in the lower part of the house. This surprised me, and I went to investigate. The light I found came from the dining room window. I approached cautiously and looked in. I saw a big man sitting at the table with a demijohn of whiskey before him. He was drinking. By his side was a rifle. The blinds were open, and before I could get away, he spied me and ordered me to come in. I obeyed. It would have been better for me if I had fled. As soon as I entered the room, the strange man poured out a glass of whiskey and handed it to me. I tried to push it aside. I tried not to take it, but I found resistance was useless. The man bent his eyes on me in a savage way, and I felt compelled to do as he said. As soon as I set down the glass, he refilled it. "Drink," he said, and again I obeyed. A third time he filled the glass, and against my will, a third time I drank. I was powerless to shake off the peculiar influence this fellow exerted over me. I began to realize I was at his mercy, that I was hypnotized. "Take this," he said, thrusting a handful of jewelry into my pocket, "and do you understand you are to say nothing about where it came from? Tomorrow I will meet you and give you more." He then appointed a time and place in Oakland, gave me $2, and put me out of the house. I don't exactly know how I spent the time. I wandered about until the hour arrived for me to meet the man, but he failed to make his appearance. By this time, the hypnotic influence had measurably worn off, and I realized it would not do for me to be found with Mrs. Thompson's jewelry in my possession. At first, I thought I would return to Berkeley and give it to her, but I concluded she would not understand and would not believe my story about the hypnotizing. So I came over to the city and tried to sell the jewelry. Who the mysterious man is, I do not know. I never saw him before. How I regret I ever saw him at all. New York Tribune, July 11, 1905. Dressed in a set of boys' knickerbockers, a 16-year-old girl was found in Concourse Park, Coney Island, yesterday morning. At the police station, she admitted she was a girl, but seemed unable to tell who she was or how she got to Coney Island. At the Children's Society, she told such a peculiar story that the officers thought she must have been affected by the heat, or possibly by drugs. She said that a woman with wonderful yellow hair and black eyes lured her away. She woke up in a house, and her hair had been clipped off and was beside the bed. Her own clothing had been removed, and in its place she found the boy's suit. This she put on and escaped. The girl said she was Kate McKinley. Agents found the girl's aunt, with whom she lived, at number 456 Myrtle Avenue, Brooklyn. The society decided to keep the girl until today, when she will be confronted by her aunt and mother. Her hair was found in her pocket. The McKinley story in particular, I find especially interesting, because of her mention of a black-eyed woman. A detail which, I'm sure, was influenced by accounts of the coffin abduction 2 years earlier. And that's the end of this episode. A list of sources consulted for this episode can be found in the show description. If you have a question, a comment, or if you know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see covered, leave a comment on the podcast page, post it to our Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, or send it to our email at ForgottenDarkness77, lowercase f, lowercase d, all one word, at gmail.com. We're also now on Twitter at Forgotten Darkness Podcast. And so until next episode, this is Andrew, signing off.